Welcome to Cybersecurity Vault. I'm your host, Matthew Rosenquist, cybersecurity strategist and CISO at Eclipse. Today, we're going to talk about cybersecurity in space. I'll be talking with Peter Streed, who serves as the Chief Strategy Officer for Nebula Space, a new startup focused on enabling compute in orbit. Now, this is a little interesting here, if you think about this. Our digital world, although it touches in space, there isn't a whole lot of processing that's going on out there, and yet there's a lot of data that can be gathered and processed and so forth. Most of what we deal with in cybersecurity is terrestrial-based. So this has got my interest, and I'm really looking to get some insights from Peter in regards to how this all intersects and how the future of computing in space, and specifically cybersecurity around that, how that's going to touch everybody here with our feet on terra firma. So with that, wanted to let everybody know today's podcast is created in part by Eclipse, which provides an elegant capability to secure data in transit across insecure networks between untrusted endpoints and cloud instances. With that, welcome, Peter. Thank you for coming and talking with us today.
Thank you, Matthew. Great to be here.
So tell us what you mean by cybersecurity in space. It's tantalizing. It's like it needs to be on a billboard somewhere. I love it. Are we talking space startups? Are we talking just, crunching numbers out there? What are we talking about?
Yeah, so I think, Matthew, we're talking about a whole industry of change. Space is such a different place to be in, and you really need to rethink security as we know it in many ways. So cybersecurity in space will be a game changer, I think, in terms of the whole operation of security, whether it's physical security or pure sort of software security. You have elements of new sort of territory in space, which just doesn't exist on Earth, and it just brings it to a whole new level.
So cybersecurity is around protecting data and systems and services. Who are the customers that we're looking? I mean, it's starting to get crowded out there from what I understand, especially with more satellites and stations and everybody talking about going to Mars and to the moon and all sorts of things. I mean, who are those big customers that you're seeing starting to come out of the woodwork that would be thinking about all of this?
Yeah. So you have, generally speaking, you have three categories of customers right now. You have the nations, states that have been at this for quite some time, the legacy of the space industry for a number of nations around the world. And then you have the, let's call it the big operators, and those would be companies that have been into aviation and now are using those same capabilities to move into space. And then you have perhaps the most exciting part of the industry, the startups that are new, novel, and really innovating very, very fast and sometimes moving by factors of the multiples of times faster than any legacy operator.
Now, we've had satellites up in space, well, since Sputnik, right? And so there's always been data telemetry things. What's changing? Why this new area? What makes it so different than the communications to Sputnik?
Yeah. So I think there's a number of factors that are changing right now. You have capital that's coming into these startups and to legacy industries as well. And what started out as a nation sort of state investment to just protect national interests have now taken on a commercial side. And with the commercial side, you're seeing actors and you're seeing capital flowing in faster than before. So those two coincided right now. So the fact that you have both companies that have not been in space before moving in, and I'll give you some examples of sectors, you combine that with the fact that the big VCs and the investors in general are seeing it. Those two combined at the same time, that accelerates the commercialization of space. And just to put things in sort of perspective, last year there were over $200 billion of VC money coming into startups globally. and the space investments were about 10 billion. 10 billion is still a big number, and that's enough to, you know, spur investments of a whole stream of new startups innovating. Some of the sectors that are really growing fast has to do with Earth observation. Earth observation can take many forms, right? It could be anything from real estate to observing transportation. And then there's obviously the classical areas of weather, environment, looking at wildfires. There's so many things you can do from space, which you can't do as effectively from Earth.
So there's money here on the line, which means there's innovation. We've got new players coming in, and it sounds like now we've got new capabilities. I'm assuming, especially when we're talking imaging, we're talking sensors, data. Are we talking about, high performance computing that's now needed to be out, floating around, in orbit?
Yeah, so one of the biggest challenges you have once you're up in orbit is that while it's easy to take a picture of a very high sort of density and granularity, it's not as easy to transmit all that data down. And there's a number of reasons for that, including just simple facts like it's cloudy. You know, things that anything that would impact your ability to transmit data straight down to a receiver, especially when you're that high up, will impact your ability to get it down in a fast way. So yes, the alternative is that you process the data in orbit, and that opens up a whole new range of opportunities. So again, while you can easily generate terabytes and literally terabytes of that data from sensors, even 5G devices and those cameras, you can't send it down as fast, but you can process it in orbit, which is the big sort of game changer.
Got it. So the moment you start doing that high performance computing in space, you're not only gathering the data and just offloading it, you're gathering the data, you're storing it, you're processing it, you're analyzing, getting something out of it of value, and then disseminating it out. And that's where cybersecurity comes into play, right? Because that's where the bad guys, they may choose to undermine that confidentiality or the integrity of the data or the availability of the system, something like that. I can only imagine, a ransomware hacker's dream is to take over a satellite somewhere and be able to ransom that off. Okay, so the cybersecurity is starting. I mean, I'm seeing this picture out there where you've got, and I would assume these are like servers, right? Servers in space. You're talking payloads that have compute and memory and storage and everything else. I mean, what does this look like in practical terms?
So right now we are at the very inception of compute in space. These are the very early days, and to make a comparison again, I would take us back to maybe, when internet started, sort of early 90s, when it was just in its infancy, and you just started to first see the first emails flowing around. That's how early on we are. Not to say that there's not a lot of players waiting to aggressively go in, but we are definitely really early on. If you today were to look at the thousands of satellites that are up in the sky, very few of those have anything that we would call high performance compute today. They have compute, but you wouldn't call it high performance by any means. So over the next couple of years, you will see that change, and you will see a lot of high performance compute server capability grade equipment be able to process the data in space.
So if we're just in the beginning steps, and the analogy is great, right? The first inception of the internet or World Wide Web or online services, any of those, what we see today is definitely not the end state, but it does create a catalyst. We've seen this in the past where these kind of greenfield technologies and innovations create a catalyst for other innovations, technologies, capabilities, and services that could impact and benefit societies all over the globe. Is this why investors are pouring money into this? Because it is that trigger for innovation?
Yeah, I think this is the foundational element in a industry. And if you're early, if you're first in any industry, you may be able to grab a piece of the infrastructure, right? And there will be those that provide the foundational infrastructure, and they will benefit from owning the land, let's call it, right? If you're the landowner, you know, buying some land in New York early on, once you grab that piece of land, you can benefit from the rent at Manhattan, right? And setting the standards in space will work a similar way. There is a need, you know, you need standards for everything, and you also need technologies to enable those standards to come through and realize them. So the more aggressive you go in now early on, the better your chances are that you can be first and in a similar fashion go in and maybe capitalize on many consumers that turn to you long term, and you scale and you grow from that point.
First mover advantage. I hear that deal to originally buy Manhattan was probably pretty good for the buyer's side, from what I understand. Yeah. Worked out quite well. Okay, but we're not talking about expansion into the West and we're pushing some wagons out there. We're talking space, yes. Right? This is incredibly cold. It's a vacuum. You've got radiation. It's not like you can just send a tech out there, right? Help me understand some of the challenges that the industry is looking at and how they're starting to overcome them, or at least explore how to overcome them.
Yes. Yeah, and you're right. So when we think about challenges, first of all, it's almost like a worst case scenario. You have a pizza oven heat coming from the sun, and that makes it extremely hot, actually as hot as a pizza oven if you're close to the sun and looking at the sun. On the other hand, outer space is really cold as it gets. So you have the worst combination of both. The side of any satellite that is turned to the sun will get enormous heat, burning heat, and the other sides will get enormous cold. And then on top of it, you have that outer radiation X-rays that are just hitting you from all over the place. So really, this is one of the worst places to be. And add to that the launch. You need to be able to prepare equipment that can withstand the forces on a launch up to space. So it can't get much worse than that. Now, those are some of the basic challenges to overcome. And once you overcome those, you are in a great position because you can benefit from heat, you can benefit from cold. There is a renewables energy element here which will continue to grow, and the technologies are being developed as we speak. You know, it is beneficial, as we know, talking about the IT sector, they move north, right? The big data centers are moving north because it's cooler, and logic says that it's cold in space, then theoretically you should be able to capitalize on that too. So there's many benefits of using those attributes in space if you can figure out the way to develop technology that benefits from a renewables perspective. And then when it comes to durability, the longevity in space, you have to develop either a technology that lasts very long in these environments, or to your point, there's now a logistics industry showing up with drones, devices that can fly around and replenish. On Earth, we were talking about doing a hot swap of a server. You know, in a data center, you can replace something very quickly. In space, right now you can't do that, but who knows, you know, into the future, you'll have the possibility to do a lot of things like that.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah, and you're right. I mean, the components have to be hardened to where they can even survive a launch with, you know, G-forces. They have to deal with that heat and the cold and the radiation, which we know can cause havoc. And if something breaks down, I mean, there has to be built-in resiliency. But on the flip side, the irony is that same heat and that same cold can be leveraged for power and for cooling and everything else. So it becomes kind of both an engineer's nightmare and an engineer's dream, I suppose, to be able to address these challenges and take advantage of what Mother Nature is providing out there, I guess. It's amazing to me. So what kind of customers do you think are going to be first in looking for that high performance? Who are those cherry customers that the industry are really trying to court right now?
Yeah, so you have a number of sectors going in here, and I would say, first of all, across the world, most governments are really interested in this in general, and they want to see their nations succeed. So the nations, the governments are taking the lead. I think that's just a reality across the world. And beyond the nations, you have sectors that can benefit from this type of image processing. So those would be, again, two classes. You are a commercial operator, a company today that deals with massive data on Earth that has to do with terrestrial or imaging pictures. And I'll give you some examples. Real estate would be one. If you think about it, you know, what better can you do than take pictures from above? And the more granular they are, the better you can see the landscape, the homes, the housing. Transportation, logistics, congestion. If you're in the transportation sector and you deal with transportation, whether it's on the ground or up in the air, in both those cases, monitoring logistics, transportation, that's obviously, anyone who is a DHL style operator, anyone who monitors that across the globe and wants to see not only their own vehicles, but anyone else's, they would benefit from having an eye in the sky, right? And then there is a third part, which is yet to come over time, as we see more 5G devices on Earth. Any 5G device long-term will generate an increasing amount of data. And in some cases, you may benefit from being able to monitor that data and see and absorb it and back up it and really capitalize on the ability to see it from above. So those are just some examples, and there's many, many more. And I would say what's nice about this industry right now is you do have a combination of those legacy large industry players. Many of them you'd recognize logos from today's aviation industry as an example. Those same players are active. And then you have completely new startups going in and doing some really fun things and revolutionary things. And you have that mix, which is nice to see.
So you just described many different facets of value. And, you know, whenever we see value, we always see attackers not that far behind. You're mentioning nation state, you're mentioning surveillance information and communications processing and a whole bunch of other things. I'm imagining the threat actors. I'm listing them in my mind, in the back of my mind, right? You've got nation states that may want to be able to, you know, grab this information from other nations. So you've got nation state attackers. You've got, obviously, cyber criminals, right? They're going to want to be able to take over and ransomware these things off or you know, do denial of service. You've got data miners that would also be interested in being able to siphon information, from these systems out in space. In fact, I can't think of a threat agent that wouldn't be interested in being able to compromise these types of systems. So how important is cybersecurity in this entire architecture moving forward? Is it something that's being looked at now? Is it something that maybe will be more addressed later? How do you see that from an importance and a priority perspective?
It is a gatekeeping, decision-making factor in everything. And I called it the game changer early on because a couple of things are different, right? One is you have the chance to define something from scratch. Originally, when you think of internet, there wasn't as much cybersecurity issue as we have today. And you sort of backed into trying to solve for some of that. Now, at least, there is a much higher awareness of what can be a cybersecurity threat, and you can much more proactively incorporate it in the design from early on. So that's a big advantage. And it also means, on your question, I don't know of a single player who's not concerned about security because everyone has seen what can happen. And it also means there is investments going into some very, very exciting new technologies that we haven't even tried really, I would say, much at Earth yet, but will be part of this sort of space experiment. And that's also interesting to see how that will pan out. And maybe in some cases, there's something that comes up in space which could be used in more regular data centers on Earth.
Anything that you want to hint at for new technologies potentially being explored?
I think just any of the new technologies that we see around quantum would probably be part of it.
That would make a lot of sense, being able to process smaller space, tremendous amount of processing power. That would make a lot of sense. All right. You'd mentioned leadership and Nebula. Tell us a little bit about what Nebula is doing from a leadership perspective in this industry. How are you pushing it forward and guiding it down a productive road?
So we're taking a phased approach, and what that means is we're trying to prove use cases that resolve, first of all, the most fundamental issues we talked about here. There are some very practical issues we discussed about compute. That's one. And then the second one, it ties in actually into your questions on cybersecurity. We have to show use cases where not only did we solve for those space environmental issues, but we also proved that, look, here's an example of a customer. We have a use case in place which allows for compute and bandwidth and everything else, and it's secure. Once you've proven that, then you can think about this over phase two. Now you can scale it. And with scaling it, of course, comes another range of sort of issues. As you scale, now you're more exposed, and then you can start to step up the security and the design to achieve that. So leadership here means, we're heavily innovating, and we're also partnering with some very, very large known partners that you have today, commercial players, just to make sure we have the backing that's required to make an effective solution.
Well, you mentioned partnerships. So what does that look like? I'm trying to imagine, okay, we're putting HPC, high performance computing in space. So you've got hardware and components. Is it that you're looking to partner with individual companies and you're including that into their payloads, into their objects, their satellites? Or are you looking at a potential model where you're going to have, I guess, more of a generic data center that's orbiting that can communicate with various different customers? And provide HPC as a service for a community that's orbiting.
Yeah, so I think when you look at this long term, it has to scale. And in that design, Matthew, it would have to incorporate everything you just discussed. That's one. The second one is that by partner here, I mean the fact that similar to what we've seen over the last 3 decades on Earth, the space it will likely be no different. We know from the day one that whatever we do, we're not going to be alone, and whatever we develop would have to be at least open enough to be able to accommodate for more than one player. It's unrealistic to think that we could go in and do sort of a how shall I put it, a more of a closed standard play, which relies on things that are so unique that no one else can replicate it. That is probably not sustainable in this environment. It's more likely that you can take something that is a little bit more open, used by commercial partners, and you can sort of ride a wave and spread it easier than trying to stay narrow. Those are some of the basic principles we use. Open standards in a broader sense, something that's you can really scale, and something that also allows multiple commercial partners to come in and play. And those partners could be in all the areas you discussed. And it could be networking, it could be the storage element, it could be a lot of these facets, right, that you need to be able to deliver a solution.
So then you're also talking about the potential of mesh networking, right? Within space and enabling that as a competitive advantage, and even servicing customers, various customers that are part of networks that aren't necessarily terrestrial based, correct?
Yeah, and I think in the future here, what you would like to see, if you think about, let's say, 10 years out in space, when you have both the Earth observation, looking at the Earth, all these companies that are providing services for the Earth based weather, environmental, transportation services, and you have logistics in space between satellites, you will need quite open, scalable standards And when it comes to networks in particular, you have both governments around the world now fairly actively going out saying, look, this has to be something that is redundant, resilient. It can't be, you know, closed off one single sort of cable or communication channel. It's almost moving the opposite way. It's so moving in a place where the networking will be, at least the, let's call it the design principles here, is we want to be able to have multiple parties on the same network. You hear players, you hear industry players as well as government saying, look, maybe we can accommodate having both government and commercial on one same network, with all the questions that, you know, comes with that statement. But so those discussions are held, and that's obviously exciting and also scary when you think of it from a security standpoint.
So is computing in orbit, is it a stepping stone to eventually computing on the moon and even to Mars? Is the learnings that you're going to create and discover going to help us push further out?
I think that is a definite result of this. I think the more compute you have in space, the more you'll be able to do. And just like some of the telescopes you first built on Earth moved to the orbit, you know, being able to observe anything in space from orbit, just putting the telescope in orbit helped a bit. And now if you can move compute into space, you're going to up that capability many, many factors, and small things we did in space will now become much, much larger and much more effective.
Well, and as, you know, mankind is pushing really hard to establish bases on the moon, do more exploration, and especially, right, on Mars, having a dependency to do any heavy compute back at Earth, it's just too far away, right? I mean, you would have to have that kind of capability in very distant planets to be able potentially to survive.
You're absolutely right. And ironically, when you look at the industry right now for space startups, you'll see individuals that came from the legacy of working with NASA, working on these type of missions that you just described, working on space vehicles that had, you know, your iPhone probably has more compute power than some of those spacecrafts. If you take that now and you get really excited because you realize if you had one of those supercomputers available, you can just do so much more, and the whole mission just changes. So yes, it is a game changer from that perspective, certainly when it comes to outbound space exploration.
And I'm sure many of us want to go to Mars, but most of us probably will never go to Mars. So last question for you. So for the average user, and I'm sure you've put thought into this, how does high-performance computing into space, how do you think that's going to change and affect our lives, the lives of everyday people in the next 10 or 20 years? What are we going to see that's different in our lives that we should be looking forward to?
Yeah, I think there's quite a few very likely potential benefits to individual consumers. And you can just think of a few examples. As an example, even from pure safety and security around us, you know, what if law enforcement had better access to better pictures if there had been an incident? What if you could catch a wildfire earlier on? What if you could process that type of data? What if you could make better decisions on real estate? There's all these small services that we use as consumers, or we rely on, you know, community serving us. All of those could really improve and very likely will improve based on what we're seeing now over the next 10 years for sure.
Do you think medicines that's being developed in space, especially as we're using high-performance computing here on Earth to figure out some of these combinations and turning around genomes and doing all sorts of splicing and things, do you think that will also be one of the drivers in developing medicines in zero gravity and the compute that supports that? Do you think that is something that we're going to see in the next 20 or 30 years?
Yes, I would make a broader sort of statement on that, which is you can do a lot of experiments in space, which you can't do on Earth. And to your point, the ability to bring up much more compute power to support that type of analysis in orbit opens up the door not only for innovations, but also funding. And you're seeing right now some governments taking the lead on promoting, you know, the ability for researchers to be able to fund these type of experiments. In the past, maybe you put a small box, you know, in a rocket launcher, and that was your experiment, and at best it came to the ISS. And it sometimes can be very limited, and it can't be very exhaustive. Now we're talking about a whole new scale of experiments, as you were sort of insinuating, which is you can literally build a full-blown, much, much more advanced lab, which is dedicated to being a lab in orbit, and you can do a whole range of new experiments, yes.
So then that supports entirely new economies of investment then. That becomes, again, another catalyst to drive those technologies in space for competitive advantages for all sorts of different sectors than I would imagine.
Yeah, and I think it's a good test to do for anyone thinking about space, regardless of what industry they're in. It is amazing how many use cases you find if you take any industry you're working in today. In most of them, you actually can find some benefits of having a space sort of application. Not all by far, but for sure, many more than you perhaps initially thought will benefit from space use cases, and will also drive, you know, funding and startups into that world.
Awesome. There's just so much to cover here. When you talk with audiences and, you know, and you're opening eyes of people that you're explaining this to, what's the one or two things that you just want to get across? You want people to understand and embrace?
Oh, it is that space compute in general has the potential to really change fundamentally a number of sectors, industries on Earth today. And we're really just at the very inception of this. And those changes are coming faster also than I think some expect. Over the last 2 years in particular, like we mentioned before, the amount of VC funding has just skyrocketed into large amounts, and there is no sign of decline. On the opposite, it seems to accelerate. So I think both commercial sort of observers as well as the individual consumers will see these changes come over the next 5 years even, is the horizon I would take, 5 years for something to trickle down to individual consumer use.
Wow, that's amazing. That's right around the corner, you know, in reality. That's tremendous. Well, I'm excited. Thank you so much for sharing what's coming around, right? What we're going to see and how that's going to help mankind continue to move up into the stars and help people with feet on the ground moving forward. Thank you so much for your insights today.
Well, thank you, Matthew. It was a pleasure being here.